you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. E. Michael Jones back on the show. Of course, Dr. Jones is the editor of Culture Wars magazine, the author of several books, including The Slaughter of Cities, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History, Barren Metal, and of course, he's working on right now is The History of Logos and The Logos of History. Dr. Jones, how are you doing?
Good, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for coming back on the show.
You're welcome.
Now, I guess this is an article, a very long article, that's going to be part of that book, right? Am I correct?
Yes.
About
that? Okay. Yes, right. That's
so,
right.
So it's basically a big chapter part of that book, but you decided to publish this article in two pieces in Culture Wars magazine, also an ebook and a short book that you can now purchase on Amazon. It's called Beyond the Bomb, Werner Heisenberg and Jewish Science.
Right, that's right.
It's about, close to 100 pages, I guess, if I recall.
Yes. I got tired of writing long articles, so I'm now publishing short books.
Yeah, good, because I'm glad, because I was able to, I read the first part, and then I was waiting for the second part, or I think it just came out today, but I got the book a couple weeks ago, I was able to finish off and, you know, finish the article. So, you wrote this article about Werner Heisenberg, some of the intrigues involving nuclear physics during the war, the Nazi Party in Germany, and Jewish science, and also the post-war era, and the corruption of Germany in the the 50s and 60s during the economic miracle.
Yes.
But you inspired to write this article by your visit to the Bavarian Alps. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I was invited to give a talk in Bavaria in October, and I used the opportunity to go hiking in the mountains. I'd been there 40-some years ago, remembered it vaguely, and then met someone on the internet, and we got together, and we went hiking. So we climbed the Herzogstand, and we walked around the Chiemsee, and it was a beautiful experience. Because it's not just beautiful because of nature, it's beautiful because of the way man has kind of tamed it and made it a work of art, as opposed to just a work of nature. And, so it was a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be there. What I mean by this is when you climb a mountain in the United States. Not that I've climbed a lot, but, you know, you're pretty much on your own. You know, you struggle to the top, you struggle back down again. Climb a mountain in Bavaria, and there at the top of the mountain, there's a restaurant. And a nice restaurant on top of that, and no parking lot. So everybody there had to hike there to get it, to get there. And you have a decent meal, and you have a beer, and you look out over the beautiful landscape, and then you walk down again. So it's that's not the way it is in America, just not the way it is. And Werner Heisenberg discovered this. He spent a lot of time hiking in the mountains of Bavaria, and he said that it helped him to understand physics. Helped him to understand nature. And I think what he's saying here is he helped him to understand that there was an order to nature. He was famous. He received the Nobel Prize in 1932 for his work in quantum mechanics. So he was a famous person. He got to travel all around the world. And one of the places he traveled was the United States of America during this period of time. And he ended up at Yosemite and decided, well, I'm here, I'll climb a mountain. And he said it was the most miserable experience of his life because there were no trails, there was no restaurant at the top, and he was so exhausted by having to blaze his own trail that he fell asleep and said he was awakened by a bear licking his cheek. So this is, I'm trying to make the point here is that he probably wouldn't have discovered quantum mechanics if he had grown up in America. And at this point of the game, there was no, physics wasn't as big in America as it was in Germany and in Europe at the time. We had the Michelson-Morley experiments, which were significant and are still significant. But for the most part, the only reason that America became a power in nuclear physics was by importing scientists who were oftentimes refugees from Hitler's Germany.
Okay, so he develops this theory does he develop or refine it, of quantum physics?
Well, he's pretty much the father of quantum physics. He Niels Bohr had come up with a model for the atom, and it was basically the planetary model shrunk. It's like, honey, I shrank the universe and so there were electrons whizzing around the proton, anyway, is center in the, or whizzing around the nucleus the way planets whiz around the sun. And so it was a model where all of those things should have been very predictable, and Heisenberg found out that they were not, and basically that was not the case. It was a nice fiction. It helped you explain, maybe help you understand what's going on, but it wasn't really an accurate model of the atom. Heisenberg's research came at the end of the 19th century and at the end, beginning of the 20th, and the legacy of that era was basically materialism. And so Heisenberg and his buddies had reverted to an obsolete form of logos. Logos had passed this stage a long time ago. They basically resurrected the materialism of Democritus. Plato knew about Democritus and rejected it as simply unsound. And it is unsound. It's an unsound philosophical principle. It's based on atoms and the void. And when you come right down to it, first of all, there's no such thing as an atom. Heisenberg discovered that. If by atom you mean what the etymology means, which is something that cannot be split. The atom, what we call the atom, can be split. And it can, and you can split the particles that split up after the atom, and you can keep splitting them. That's why they have that big atom smasher in this thing called the CERN in Switzerland or France, wherever it is, on the border between Switzerland and France. They keep doing this, and he says you can keep splitting them off until finally they just disintegrate into energy. So there's no atom. Secondly, there's no void either. Because if there's a void, then there's nothing there. And if there's nothing there, well, those two things are touching. Well, they're not touching. So what's there between, let's say, the Earth and the Sun? What is it? It's not air, because air stops about 6 miles up. What is it then? It's nothing? Is it the void? Well, if there's nothing there, then the earth and the sun are touching. Well, that's obviously not the case, because we'd all be toast if that were the case. So it was an incoherent philosophical model, an incoherent philosophical stage of development that had been superseded by subsequent development of the concept of logos, in particular by Plato, first of all, who replaced all this materialist mumbo jumbo with the concept of form, and then Aristotle, who located form in the thing itself, called entelechy, and logos really progressed from that point. That's where the word logos took off, and Heisenberg caught it at the tail end of basically an obsolete era, an era of obsolete physics. He put an end to it. He kind of put the bullet through the head of that, of materialism. At the end of his life, Heisenberg was a Platonist. And he said he didn't believe in atoms anymore. He believed that there were forms. He didn't believe in little material balls, little particles. He said there were forms, and that was that. There wasn't. It was form and matter. We were back to Plato and Aristotle now.
It is interesting that modern physics, properly understood, would seem to vindicate Plato's vision, although Plato was, you know, dealing with the 4th century B.C., and he would have that insight, whereas it was dropped by the materialist of the 19th century.
Yeah, he was a very, he was like the flower of German culture. In many ways, the flower of Bavarian culture. He was a Protestant, and I've got different opinions about his Protestantism vis-a-vis Catholicism from his niece and his daughter, both of whom wrote me letters after reading the article. But he was the flower of German culture. His father was a classics professor. He read Greek, in the original Greek. He was a great musician. He was a cultured man, and he just carried that whole thing forward to its logical conclusion and returned it to Plato.
So he had the depth to think philosophically as well.
He did. Yeah. He had a great education. An education we would all be should have, but we don't. Okay, we don't anymore. And this was in many ways Germany at the high point of its culture. I mean, Germany didn't really come into existence as a nation until 1871. So we're talking, he was born 30 years later. So Germany's on the rise when he's born, and it came. You could see it in this expression of German culture. Which reached out and linked up with the international physics community, and it was an exciting time to be involved in physics, no question about it. But it was also it coincided with Europe's suicide, mm-hmm. namely World War I, mm-hmm. and then followed by the sequel of the rise of the Nazis. And at this point, Heisenberg gets in trouble. Because he is a defender of Einstein, and now when the Nazis come to power, the guys who have been out in the cold, I'm talking about Stark and Lenard, who also had won Nobel Prizes in physics, but had just the new physics had just passed them by. Now they have political power, and now they're going to settle the scores with what they call Jewish science. So this is the first appearance of Jewish science in the article, and it's basically Einstein's physics. And Heisenberg defends Einstein, and he gets in trouble with the SS. And they write an article about him, and they're calling him a white Jew. because whatever that means.
Yeah.
Because he's defending Einstein. And so it's in one of those touching moments, Werner goes home and he complains to his mother. And his mother just happens to know the mother of Heinrich Himmler, who is the head of the SS. So Heinrich Himmler's mother calls him in and said, listen, Werner's a nice boy. I know his mother. Why are you attacking him? And so Himmler then writes Heisenberg a letter saying, I apologize for the attack against you in Schwarzer Corps. And there will be no more further attacks. So it was a really touching moment, I think, in this whole thing.
It's nice to have friends in high places.
Yeah, it's nice, especially if your mother knows the mother of the head of the SS. It's always good. have connections like this. And so Heisenberg was saved, and Heisenberg is a German in body and soul. He's going to stick it out. He's not leaving. They made him plenty of offers. He could have gone over to Los Alamos with all the other Germans, the German Jews who left, who did work on the bomb, but he stayed. And then so he gets drafted into the army at the time when war breaks out. And they put him in charge of war production. You're going to work on war production. And then Albert Speer comes to him, the guy who's the boss, and he says, can we build an atomic bomb? And Heisenberg says, yeah, I think we could. And he said, well, how big would it have to be to take out London? And Heisenberg says, well, about the size of a pineapple. So this piques Speer's interest. And then according to Heisenberg's account, he then told Speer, yeah, we can do it, but we don't have the money or the men or the material, and everything I take away from the other war effort to put in this thing will detract from the war effort where we could get a quicker return on other weapons. And so at this point, Speer says, okay, and that's the end of the German atomic bomb. Now, Heisenberg met with Niels Bohr, and this has become the source of a play and a movie now, his conversation with Niels Bohr. He goes up to Denmark, goes up to Copenhagen, and tries, according to him, it's a kind of tortured story, but basically Heisenberg is really nervous because this could be considered treason. He's already on the list of the SS as a suspicious character. He wants to tell Bohr, we're not producing the bomb. We could, but we're not going to. So why don't you tell all of our friends in America, don't produce it over there. Bohr mangles this either intentionally or else Heisenberg is not telling the truth. And he then escapes to, Bohr is a Jew. He escapes then to the West, and then he tells them Germany's building the bomb, which then has the exact opposite effect that Heisenberg wanted, because then the American effort goes into high gear and they do produce a bomb. Heisenberg was completely in the dark about this. The Americans lied to him about what was going on. And then finally, as a prisoner of war in England in August of 45, the news comes that the United States has dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and then Nagasaki. So that's the end of that. You know, he's disillusioned. He goes back, but he still thinks that science is going to have a role in helping Germany. He read Plato. I know he read Plato, so he probably read the laws, and he probably read that part about there should be a council of guardians, the wise men. Well, in Heisenberg's day, wise man was synonymous with scientist. And so he thought, well, we'll create the scientific advisory council, and this will help prevent the return of something like Nazism in the future. That was the plan. It turns out didn't turn out that way. And that's, in a sense, the whole point of the book, the little book that I wrote about this. Okay. What happened is there was such a thing as Jewish science. It wasn't what the Nazis said it was, but there was such a thing, and it was known as psychology. Andrew Heinze wrote a book about this, how psychology is Jewish. If I say it, I'm called an anti-Semite, but when Heinze says it, he wins a Pulitzer Prize for saying the same thing. But Jewish psychiatry, psychology was a Jewish science in the 20th century. No question about it. We all know about Sigmund Freud, who was considered the father of one branch of it. There was an American branch, John B. Watson. But in terms of the post-World War II period, right after the war, what happened was that the American Jewish Committee basically brought the Frankfurt School over to New Jersey and put them to work on something, a project called the Authoritarian Personality, which was psychological warfare. It was used against Catholics in the United States during this period of time. It was used as a justification for Brown versus School Board, the Supreme Court decision, which Murray Friedman says was a Jewish decision. And it was used in Germany without any restraint whatsoever. There were no external restraints whatsoever because Germany was a conquered country and it was lying prostrate. It fell in with basically it became the tool that was going to implement Jewish revenge against Germany. Jewish revenge had been brewing ever since the 1930s, ever since probably Kristallnacht. Books were published, Germany must be destroyed, stuff like this. And then you finally had the champion of Jewish interest in this regard was Henry Morgenthau. Henry Morgenthau was the Secretary of Treasury under President Roosevelt, and he took a keen interest in how Germany was going to be punished after World War II. And his plan, what he orchestrated was something called the Morgenthau Plan. The Morgenthau Plan was basically to starve the Germans to death. It was that simple. It was genocide, and it would have gone through but for the fact that Franklin Delano Roosevelt died. Harry Truman became president. Harry Truman could not stand Morgenthau. And at that point, there were adults in the room who came to the conclusion that, yeah, I guess we can starve Germany to death, but that means the Soviet Union takes over all of Europe. And so in the spring of 47, after the famous Hungerjahr, that's what the hunger year, where the Germans almost starved to death, the winter of 46 and 47. After that, George Marshall shows up at Harvard University and announces there's a new plan. The new plan is called the Marshall Plan, and the enemy now is not the German people as it was under the Morgenthau Plan. The enemy now is hunger, and now the food starts pouring into Germany. And they also have a currency reform. And at this point, they have money to spend. And so guess what comes into Germany as soon as the Germans have money to spend? What is it?
Not blue jeans and the hula hoop, but something else, right?
No. What came into Germany, 50 tons of it came across the Austrian border at this moment in time.
Smut and filth.
Smut, or as the Germans would call it, Schmutz und Schund, smut and filth, or filth and smut, however you want to call that. A completely archaic term, but this was, in effect, phase two now of the plan for Jewish revenge against Germany. So we're not going to starve them to death. We're going to engage in their social engineering by corrupting their sexual morals.
So no longer physical destruction. Enough of that was carried out during the war. Now we're dealing with their spiritual and psychological destruction.
That's right. That's exactly what happened. And so what you had now were a whole group of people who are now administering Germany. They have all these names like the Office for the Control of Information. I mean, I like that. At least you're being honest in a way by telling us what you're doing. Now in the new defeated Germany, if you wanted to publish a book or a magazine or produce a play or a film or anything like that, you had to get a license. And the man handing out the licenses was a Jewish psychiatrist from New York City. And in order to get it, you had to go to him and write an essay on why the German people are guilty guilt and stuff like that. His name was David Mordecai Levy. At this point, you had the Jewish social engineers basically determining what the Germans are going to read and what they're going to think. And at that point, we begin to see an inundation, a slow inundation. It builds up, begins slowly, and then sorts of builds up. So you had 50 tons of obscene material crossing the border immediately after the currency reform. And then after that, you've got the spread of obscene material throughout the culture.
And this seems to be following not only the plans of the American Jewish Committee, but also the works of Frankfurt School, members like Wilhelm Reich, right?
Wilhelm Reich had come over to America as well. Wilhelm Reich is a crucial figure. I've talked about him before. He's I have chapters on him in my book Libido Nandi. Mm-hmm. He is in many ways the architect. One of the major architects of sexual liberation as a form of political control, and he was put to work by the American Jewish Committee. The problem was, I have my own personal theory about Wilhelm Reich. He went to whorehouses during World War One. The chances of coming out of a whorehouse after World War One without a venereal disease are slim at best. Mm-hmm. And so my theory is that he contracted syphilis during World War One because of and syphilis often goes to the brain. And it gives you delusions of grandeur. And I think this explains Reich of the 1950s in the United States.
The Orgone box and that stuff.
The Orgone box, yeah. All this other type of stuff. I think that the United States, whatever the powers that be, they figured this guy is completely crazy. We got to do something. So they arrested him and they put him in prison in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. And he died there because of his you get delusions of grandeur. And that's what he was doing in Maine, at that place in Wrangley, Maine. He was experimenting with radium, contaminating the place for the next 5 million years. And so they just took him in, and that was the end of Wilhelm Reich. Okay, he resurrected, a posthumous resurrection during the revolution of 1968 in Paris. He was, in many ways, the architect of that. He was the architect of the New Left, which is basically sex rather than economics. And he was also ended up on the cover of the New York Times magazine in 1970. So he had a much greater career after he was dead. He's sort of like Elvis. Mm-hmm. His death was a really good career move.
Yeah, he cast a long shadow of the 20th century. But he's the one, I think he wrote, anyone who wants to combat fascism has to proceed from the assumption that the family is a central reactionary germ. So his whole focus was destroying the family, primarily through sexual economics, as you termed it, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's so. This is the type of person that got unleashed on Germany at the time, and there was only one institution that recognized this as a threat, and that was the Catholic Church. And so, in very many ways, the parallels, kind of uncanny parallels, with the United States. The Catholic Church created its own Legion of Decency in Germany. It was called the Volksratbund. And they had a charismatic guy at the head of it, and he went after Schmutz und Schund, hammer and tongs, went after it and made a lot of headway in the 50s. Got children, young people burning books. Oh, wait a minute, stop. Let's consider the optics here. Especially when the Jews control your press, consider the optics here. And so what you had here was a man who understood the threat. There's absolutely no question, and there was a threat. He understood it, but he was handicapped by the vocabulary that he was using and the image that he projected. You know? Mm-hmm. And he wasn't a scientist. Let's get straight here. And this gets to the heart of my point here at this point. There was one man. Well, let me back up for a second. So we have this Schmutz und Schund, the smut is flooding in, but we need something more to put this over the top. What do we need to make this convincing to the German people? We need science. Because everybody believes in science. And who is the greatest scientist that ever walked the face of the earth currently alive in America at this time?
In the 1950s?
1950. He shows up in Germany in 1950.
Oh, yeah. Well, in regards to sexual research, obviously it's the scientist Alfred Kinsey.
Alfred Kinsey, of course. The greatest American scientist ever, scientist America ever produced. A complete fraud. A complete empty suit creation of the Rockefeller Foundation and the CIA, in particular its front operation called Time Magazine. Time Magazine puts him on the cover in 1953, I believe, with birds and bees flying around, and lets us know that he's a Boy Scout. He's a straight arrow Boy Scout. This is completely false.
Isn't he wearing a bow tie too?
He's wearing a bow tie. I have nothing against bow ties. I wear them sometimes myself. And I'm also from Indiana, and my children went to IU Bloomington. So some of them, anyway. But be that as it may, he was a complete fraud, and he wasn't a straight arrow. He was a homosexual. And as a homosexual, he had a vested, he wasn't interested in female sexuality at all. He was interested in going to gay bars and talking to those dudes about what they did in the men's room. That's what really turned him on. This is not science. Okay? But the magazines that the Jewish psychiatrist from New York City had handed out the licenses to the magazines, and they all, with one voice, treated Kinsey as if he were the scientific messiah who was going to liberate Germany from its repressive sexual taboos. That was the situation. Every illustrated magazine, like Life, remember Life? Mm-hmm. Life was the magazine for people who can't read, and Time was the magazine for people that can't think. So there were all these German equivalents of Life magazine, and the most famous, the one I remember when I was there, was Stern. And Stern would jump full with both feet on the Kinsey bandwagon. He was the greatest scientist since Galileo. Well, there's only one man in Germany who could have stood up to this. It wasn't the head of the Volksbund. It wasn't Cardinal Frings, who stood valiantly in the breach fighting pornography because he understood how it was wrecking German morals. It wasn't these two guys. There was one man who could have stood up to Kinsey, and it was Werner Heisenberg. Now, I sent you the letter I got from Barbara Heisenberg.
Are you going to publish that?
I am. It's going to be in the March issue.
Good, okay. And
I sent you my response.
Yeah.
Now, Barbara Heisenberg had some nice things to say at the beginning of her letter. She's Werner's daughter. And then she just lays into me, like, what are you doing? What does my father have to do with Kinsey? It's like an insult to the Heisenberg family to even bring Kinsey's name into association. Well, Barbara, I'm the one who said Kinsey was a fraud. I agree with you. He was a fraud. And in a sense, it is a kind of blasphemy against science to bring Kinsey together with Werner Heisenberg, who won the Nobel Prize in 1932 for quantum mechanics. But the fact of the matter is that Kinsey was being promoted as a scientist in Germany, and Kinsey's research was taken as scientifically valid. And Cardinal Frings couldn't do anything about that. What's he going to do, excommunicate Kinsey? No, he can't do that. There was only one man who could have stood up to him, and that was Werner Heisenberg. Okay, yes, he was a physicist. I understand that. But the fact of the matter is that he created the Scientific Advisory Council in 1949 to protect Germany from the abuse of science. That's what Kinsey was doing. So why didn't he say anything?
I think you suggested it was beneath him?
Beneath his dignity. Mm. I think that's why I'm glad. I want to thank Barbara for writing that letter because she, in many ways, vindicated my feelings about the whole thing. I think she reaffirmed the point that I made because of her outrage. The outrage that to think that Werner Heisenberg should have something to say about Alfred Kinsey. Well, I think he should have, because he was a patriot. He said he was concerned about the German people. That's why he created the Scientific Advisory Council. And he completely, okay, maybe he completely missed the threat. Okay, but that's his fault. That's his fault. He wasn't prepared for the real threat. He thought the threat was nuclear weapons. And so he and 17 other nuclear physicists issued a public statement telling Adenauer and Strauss not to deploy nuclear weapons in Germany. It created a postponement, but eventually they were deployed anyway. And the nuclear weapons had basically no effect whatsoever on the German people. Okay. But the Kinsey Report did have a big effect on the German people, okay? At this point, and I think that if Heisenberg had a better understanding of Logos, And he did have an understanding of Logos because he read the Greek and he did talk about this thing called a central order, which was his word for Logos. Okay. But it was a truncated understanding of Logos. It basically, even though he did go back to Plato, he still had the sense of Logos as basically little balls bumping into each other. That was obsolete. We're back to Democritus. We're back to Thales. We're back to Anaxagoras. We're back to Heraclitus, although he was better than most. Okay, but we're dealing with the impoverished understanding of philosophy that was in Europe because of that turn toward materialism that began with the death of Hegel in 1831. Karl Marx, the classic example of this turn to materialism. Darwin, another example, Spencer, all these late 19th century figures, all dealing with a completely truncated and inadequate understanding of Logos that basically set up the tragedy that happened in Germany.
In that letter that you published and your response, and you do address this in response, and I lead people to read that when you publish it. But one thing that struck me was that she seemed to be have a view that's very typical of successive generations, whereas she denies the organized malevolence of these Jewish organizations and targeting Germany with psychological warfare, and she didn't seem to be aware of the history of how this even predates, you know, this type of malevolence predates psychological warfare, predates Hitler. I mean, it goes back to Wilhelm Reich, and also you even see it in Hungary under Bela Kun. This sort of approach. And the Frankfurt School, they were exploring these ideas before Hitler's rise to power, and they left Germany. So you can't pin it on a reaction to Hitler when it predates Hitler. I mean, obviously, Freud also is sort of a black op against Christian society. So,
yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I was a little disappointed because, once again, I'm the messenger that brings the bad news. I point out that David Mordecai Levy is a Jew, and that this had some bearing on his attitude toward Germany, and she calls me an anti-Semite for bringing this up. I'm disappointed, to be honest with you.
It's the same thing when you pointed about pornography or abortion being largely Jewish operations, at least Jewish agitation and promotion, and they'll write books about it. You've made this point many times. They'll write books praising it as progressive and liberating, but you pointed out with a critical analysis, and you're an anti-Semite for it, but they're essentially saying the same thing. Yeah,
I think that's the tragedy of Germany, or at least that generation. Now we're talking about a generation. I think she's about 10 years older than I am. My professor, my philosophy professor in college, was there in Munich at the university when Heisenberg was at the height of his power. And in many ways, I use this image, but Heisenberg was like secondhand smoke in the philosophy seminar when I was in college. You know, his presence was just there. And Barbara reinforced that when she said that he had become a role model. Well, that's my point. The point I'm trying to make is, yes, I agree with you. He was a role model. He was the only role model in Germany who had the scientific clout to denounce Kinsey. And the fact that he didn't was a tragedy for Germany. Mm-hmm. Now, why he didn't, we can all speculate about why he didn't. Maybe he didn't know. But Barbara's letter gives me the feeling that he wouldn't have, even if he did know, because it was beneath his dignity. And that's the tragedy. That's the tragedy, that you've got this exalted notion of philosophy, but it's not really exalted at all. It's really truncated to the point of materialist concern about little balls bumping into each other, and you're missing the big picture. You're missing the big picture. You know, I mean, politics was part of philosophy. That's the book that Aristotle wrote. Werner knew this. That's why he created the Scientific Advisory Council, and yet they're completely, as I said in the article, hors de combat, out of bound, missing in action.
So in the 50s, you have Germany being inundated. I guess it really picks up in the 60s, I guess, with pornography. There's movies that are made, apparently, right, that start with this pornography, is what the sinful woman that's made in the movie.
I lay this out in the book. Now, we've already said you can't make any movies without a license. That means the approval of the Jewish psychiatrist from New York City. It's not going to happen. Okay? So we have this young lady, Hildegard Knef, who has already done movies with the Nazis. The Germans are defeated. She marries a Jewish soldier and goes to Hollywood, where she's put under contract. Okay, great, Hildegard. I'm glad you made it over there. Good luck. Well, oh, wait a minute. She's coming back. She's coming back to Germany. Not only that, she's going to star in a film. It's called Die Sünderin, the female sinner. We don't have, you know, we don't have genders for these things, but the lady is a sinner. That's why I tried to translate it. And it outrages everyone, not just the Catholic Church, but everyone, because it's such a blatant attempt to kick the Germans when they're down. Okay, kicking fellow Germans when they're down. All right, we're already defeated, and now you're trying to destroy what little decency we have left, what little self-respect, what little morality we have left. You're trying to destroy that, so there's outrage. And theaters are being firebombed, and there's demonstrations and everything. Okay, that's what was going on then.
And you also had, was the, I guess these were made in the 70s. Was it the Schoolhouse Reports?
No, the schoolgirl report.
Oh, okay. Schoolgirl reports.
Okay, report is not a German word, okay? But it became a German word because of those magazines. Now, virtually no one read the Kinsey Report. But everyone read about the Kinsey Report. It's the same thing over here as over there. That's what Time Magazine is there for you to do.
It's like Vatican II.
they give you the sanitized CIA version of what you're allowed to think, and you think you're getting the inside goods, and you don't have to read that dumb book. The first woman to read the book was Judith Reisman, Jewish lady, who realized, wait a minute, a lot of these tables are about the sexual molestation of children. That's criminal activity, isn't it? So was Kinsey involved in criminal activity? This was 1981, I believe, when she did this for the first time. So she reads the book, and actually it's scandalous, but by that point, nobody cared. Nobody cared. It was old news, and so Judith tried in vain, and she was just forgot, you know, made virtually no impact. But the word report enters the German vocabulary now. And the other word that enters the German vocabulary is sex. These are English words. They're not German words, okay? And so as a result, you have the battle there, but the German people are becoming demoralized in every sense of the word. And so what you have are German politicians who are just, you know, like they're politicians, like politicians here, their hearts in the right place when their money hand isn't in your wallet. And these are, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt, decent guys that don't know how to defend the social order against science. And you got these reporters just badgering these guys, and they don't know what to say, and they just don't know what to say, and so they're fighting a rear-end losing battle against obscenity for the entire 1950s and 1960s. That's what's happening. And the magazines are absolutely, this is like manna from heaven. The magazines get to break the obscenity laws, but hey, it's science. Hey, you can't object to science. And so they go to town by promoting more and more lascivious and lewd type of articles that could never have been done without the word report and Kinsey in front of them. And some guy with a lab coat and a clipboard working to overthrow the sexual morality of the German people. The church didn't know what to do about it. And the Volksbund didn't know what to do about it. And eventually the church is embarrassed, as it was here, I have to say, embarrassed by its own decency organization.
Yeah, there's an American analog to this story, which I found striking. It's parallels, the same psychological warfare and intimidation, the same way that, you know, that certain church prelates refer to secularizing radicals instead of naming the names, and I guess I could see how German politicians and officials, and critics might be intimidated from addressing the true threat, because Jewish science, as you say, is being used as psychological warfare against the German people, and to really get to the root of the problem, would be very awkward for Germans, particularly in the post-war era, considering the guilt that was laid upon them, you know, for the war. And so this
That's right,
part of that sort of that moral, spiritual extortion that also followed with the financial, you know, extortion after the war. And so they can't, they're not in a position to voice, to really get to the root of the problem, because to do so, you know, would be to, you know, well, to criticize Jewish organizations and Jewish people. And you can't do that, obviously. I mean, America wasn't even conquered. And look at the problem we have here with criticizing Jewish organizations for their malfeasance, you know.
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, let's go back even to the Legion of Decency. Joe Breen writing in private correspondence to the bishops on the committee. These Jews are the scum of the earth.
Yeah,
All they think about is sex. Well, at least Joe could name the enemy. You know, at least Joe could give a cogent explanation of who he was dealing with and what they were up to. Well, the Germans were deprived of that. There's no such thing as that. That's not possible in Germany at this point.
Hasn't the entire Western world been deprived of that ability to?
Yes.
I mean, that's so, we talked about last about Civiltà Cattolica, the you know, the
Civiltà Cattolica.
The how if you just the rhetoric. I mean, there was sort of their ability to go to the directly to the problem and address it, the theological and philosophical problems.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now, since the world wars, we can't.
No. I mean, when was the last time you heard a priest or a bishop talk about the voracious octopus of Judaism?
I haven't heard that homily lately.
That's a direct quote from the Civiltà Cattolica articles.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, nobody says that anymore for some reason. But I think what I'm trying to explain here is also the dynamic of how this happened. Because what you got here is, okay, I just read it in Stern. That's a decent magazine, I suppose. So I'm going to act on these sexual impulses that I've always been repressing. Well, wait a minute. I did that. Now I feel guilty. Well, wait a minute. There's an explanation for my guilt. It's not sex. It's the Holocaust. I feel guilty because of the way I treated Jews. I've never done anything to Jews. Okay. Some other people may have. I've never done anything. But now I understand the real cause of my guilt. It's not the sex. It's the Holocaust. And that is the transformation that the Jews, this was the alchemy of Jewish science in Germany during the post-World War II period.
Yeah, and of
course, the more you got involved in sexual liberation, the more guilt you felt, the more the Jew had power over you, because he was going to give you a kind of permission slip. You can look at all the pornography you want, as long as the guilt that comes from it you can ascribe to the treatment of the Jews. That's what happened during this period of time.
And of course,
It got worse as time went on. I know, because I was there.
Mm-hmm.
I was there 40 some years ago, and it wasn't as bad then as it is now. Now, the farther we get from the actual events of World War II, it looks the worse it's getting.
The myths take over season in history. Yeah,
Charlotte Knobloch, who is the head of the big German Jewish organization, just gave a speech in the Bavarian parliament shortly after I left, about a month or so after I left, in which she attacked the Alternative for Deutschland. There are 22 members of parliament there that were elected by the German people who voted for the AfD, or the Alternative for Deutschland. Okay, these are elected officials, and she's attacking them as anti-Semites. And so what is the response? The head of the AfD in, I think it's Bremen or Hamburg, one of those places, gets beaten almost to death. At this point, the police, instead of looking for the killer, or the mayor's almost killed this guy, they're investigating the AfD. Well, wait a minute. The AfD is the government. You're an agency of the government. You got this whole thing backwards here. But that's precisely the alchemy of Jewish science here. What I'm talking about, that's what Knobloch did. 18 of the 22 elected officials walked out in her talk, and they are demonized across the board in the German media for walking out because she insulted them.
Well, we know that, you know, German media is completely controlled. They're
yes, it yeah, is.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is not news.
Yeah.
They all had to get licenses.
Yes.
from the Jew from New York City, and they are still controlled.
Yeah.
He's gone, but they've internalized. I said many times, they've internalized the commands of their oppressors. That's the problem. That's the sense I get reading Barbara's letter. You know, why are you attacking me, Barbara? Because I said the social engineers were Jewish. They were. If what I said is false, point out the error. Don't attack me as an anti-Semite because I'm telling you what was the fact, what was the case.
Yes. Again, and of course, a good example of this idea of sort of fusing the sexual revolution using the Holocaust guilt to promote that is here in the States, you know, the movie The Pawnbroker, which is a Holocaust movie, is used to break the production code. It's the same, right, similar tactic.
Right. You couldn't criticize that movie because it was a Holocaust movie. Everybody knew at that point that it was an attempt to smuggle bare breasts onto the big screen, you know, so they don't care about the Holocaust. They use it as a vehicle to promote smut. OK, but the Catholic, the Legion of Decency is numb, can't do anything. Don't know what to do. I can't. I'll be called an anti-Semite if I bring this up.
And of course, there's also a similar story of breaking ethnic identity here in the United States and sort of changing the demographics and therefore the voting patterns and sort of the political environment to facilitate the sexual revolution that you write about in The Slaughter of Cities and also in Libido Dominandi. You write about in this article, this person with whom you're hiking is also lamenting what's going on in Germany. And you see this frustration building. He's talking and he's sort of recognizing what's going on. He's this sort of this developing consciousness of what's been done to them over the past several decades, but yes, also how this plays in today's politics. This isn't just history, because right now you have this migration crisis. And that's a big part of it, because you would have to demoralize them in the preceding decades to set Germany up for what's going on now, literally the physical destruction of the German people through migration. What's going on now, so that's important that you include that in the article, how this also plays into what's going on in Germany and sort of this plan to change the country's demographics and therefore kind of destroy Germany.
Yeah, Ulrich was very conscious of the Jewish orchestration of migration. I mean, they do the YouTube videos on it. So obviously they want to get the message out.
Yeah.
Okay. The Barbara Lerner Spector YouTube videos got millions of views, I suspect. But the point I'm trying to make here is this conversation would not have taken place 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly would not have taken place 45 years ago, which is when I was there. You know, it would not have happened. I'm sorry.
Well,
they were so. Controlled, so brainwashed, they wouldn't even entertain the idea. Well, that's breaking down now. This is what Hegel called the cunning of reason.
Yeah. But it's a similar thing I went into when I'm in a gathering and, you know, I'm in, quote, polite company.
And yes, I never get into polite company, so I don't have this problem.
I guess you said that. I'm not fit for polite company anymore. And the people are simply unaware of all this intrigue and went on, you know, with the weaponized integration and the social engineering. People still deny the level of, you know, planned malevolence that's behind these things, because integration is given a, you know, sort of a positive progressive, you know, that's our understanding of it. Well, actually, integration wasn't integrated. It's actually there to create an escape into the suburbs and actually prevent integration. Well, that lead to integration, more atomization and destruction of the ethnic neighborhoods to create suburbia and that thing. But people simply aren't aware of the level of psychological warfare that even the American people have been subjected to in the 20th century. Did you see the article the video they sent you regarding that German magazine, Baby Familia, Baba Familia?
No.
Oh, sorry. Well, this was, I just saw this on YouTube, and it's a German magazine called Baba Familia. And there's an article that read, it's something, the threat from the right. And the threat from the right is traditional German families, and primarily families in the East, rural areas. And in this article, it states that what you look for in a family like this is well-behaved children, a mother and a father, girls with long dresses and a well-braided hair, children that seem to get along, that are well-behaved, parents that want to have a community with other like parents. And this is the threat from the right. And it turns out, this is, again, this appeared to me a continuation of the assault on the German family and traditional German society. This is today. This is from a couple of years ago, 2016 and 2017. And the study in the article was funded by the Amadeus Antonio Foundation, which was established by Annette Kahane, who was an informant for the Stasi before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and her parents were Bolsheviks, Jewish activist Bolsheviks.
Yeah, yeah.
So the usual suspects. But I mean, this is the authoritarian personality being implemented. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. They did that. One of the conclusions they came to was, the earlier a child has sexual relations, the more democratic, in quotes, the child becomes when he grows up. Well, there's your program right there.
Yes.
And I saw it. I saw it firsthand. So I'm there in 73. The first Schulmädchen report comes out in 70, 71. There were 13 of them. For the entire decade of the 70s, you have one Schulmädchen report after another. So I watched it as that and Bravo. The point of both of these things is to sexualize these teenagers. They were my students at the time. They're always bringing in posters of David Bowie or something like that, you know, some type of pop star. And then you read it, go into the magazine, and there's Dr. Sommer, whose real name is Weinstein, who is advising them how to masturbate. Like, it's right out of the Wilhelm Reich playbook.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is precisely what was going on when I was there. And I'm completely befuddled trying to figure out what's going on here.
Yeah, you don't attack the idea of God or argue politics. You just preach the doctrine of free love, and notions of morality and God are forgotten.
Evaporate. That's what Wilhelm Reich said. And this was Reich in action. This was absolutely Wilhelm Reich in action. No question about it.
And didn't his also doctrine or beliefs also inform the Green Party and some of the pedophilia scandals there?
Well, Danny Cohn-Bendit was part of the Revolution of 68. And he wrote, he was part of Kommune Eins, I believe, in Berlin, or one of those operations. And he talked about sex with children in one of his memoirs. And then, of course, I didn't mean it when I said that. That was just a metaphor. So he got off scot-free. It's like Brian Singer, big article in The Atlantic about Brian Singer. But hey, they're just unsubstantiated accusations, so we're going to let him direct the film anyway.
Or Woody Allen, or
Woody Allen's another example.
It turns out that
a teenage girl came forward and said, yes, Woody had sex with me when I was 16 years old. No consequences whatsoever. Thank God, Woody, get down on your knees and thank God you're not a Catholic priest. That's
all. Yeah, no one's suing the Green Party. There's no
one's suing Hollywood either.
Yeah, no, you sue Hollywood as an institution, I guess. Yeah, yeah, no one's doing that either. Yeah, addressing that. And I think you've made this point several times in various interviews and articles, is that, of course, everywhere where the Anglo-Zio Empire goes is the promotion of sexual liberation, pornography. You wrote this in Liber de Nominandi, how the Israelis, when they went into Ramallah, took over the TV station, started broadcasting pornography. I think you've also, it's similar, there seems to be some sort of like black opera program occurring in Iran right now with distribution pornography.
There was when I was there. Okay. I mean, that's 6 years ago. They were telling me about that.
Yeah.
You go out on the doorstep to pick up the newspaper or something, and there's a DVD there, and you put it in your computer, and it's pornography. So they've been trying this for years in Iran.
And didn't also, was it Frank Colucci who head up that program in Portugal in the 70s?
Portugal. He did it in Portugal. Yeah. Right at the time of the Salazar Revolution. Portugal is flooded with pornography, and it killed the revolution. Everybody left the streets in their home looking at pornography. It was mentioned in Time magazine.
But there's some encouragement here, because I listened recently. I think your address in Poland was published without the translation. So I was listening to it, I was able to listen to it without interruption, so to speak. And you address what's Poland, where there's Catholic unity, ethno-religious unity, and they have consciousness and they have the ability to resist this. And whereas in America, Catholics have no unity. And they did have some sort of a kind of unity with the ethnic neighbors, but suburbia destroyed that. It was left them sort of atomized and defenseless against the forces of sexual revolution. which you said, I do agree, they control all the powers, all the meaningful institutions in the West now, right?
Yes, yes. And all we need is unity and we can be successful here. The Catholic Church is a force that is just waiting to be awakened. Now that we know who Cardinal McCarrick was working for, maybe we can do something about this. There is a homosexual mafia that controls the Catholic Church in America. He was one of the big players in it. The Jesuits are another group involved in this thing. They are also the big proponents of Catholic-Jewish dialogue. So look at the best, most recent example of Catholic-Jewish dialogue, Andrew Cuomo.
Yes.
And the infanticide bill. Andrew Cuomo is following the footsteps of his father, Mario, which basically means you're going to be a front for Jewish interests. It was Liz Kroger, the Jewish lady, who came up with the bill, but Andrew Cuomo is the front man for it. And once you have a Catholic front man, hey, it's sanitized, okay? It must be okay. And on top of that, now the big debate is, well, should he be excommunicated? So now you have Catholics fighting each other over whether he should be excommunicated, and the Jew remains invisible in the background. That's the way it works.
In the same way that the Catholic Church has neglected its responsibility to evangelize Jews, it's also excommunication is a necessary correction for those. It's for Andrew Cuomo's benefit that he be excommunicated, to put him on notice so he can go to confession and save his soul.
But Cardinal McCarrick is not going to do it because he's got skeletons in the closet. We're talking about blackmail here.
Mm-hmm.
And he's blackmailed by his own conscience. It's a terrible situation.
No, sorry, is that McCarrick or Dolan?
I'm talking about McCarrick. I'm not talking about Dolan. I'm talking about McCarrick in Washington.
Yeah.
Giving communion to pro-abortion.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that, yeah. Yeah, it's because here in Virginia, we had our own governor gotten some hot water over some statements about infanticide. And really, to me, this stuff has been going on. It codifies what's been going on, because, you know, I guess it just relieves the doctor the inconvenience of having to flip the baby around, keep the baby, you know, in the mother, and, you know, kill it that way. It's horrible.
It also completely explodes all of that rhetoric about abortion being a blob of tissue. Remember that rhetoric?
Yeah.
Well, no. Now it's obvious the baby's out on the table now. You're going to kill it now anyway. So there goes your rationale for abortion.
Yep.
That went down the memory hole, didn't it?
Yep. And now we're here in Virginia. The governor got in trouble for apparently either wearing a KKK costume or wearing blackface. And it's for that. I mean, this was 35 years ago in his college yearbook. And it's for that transgression that he's asked to resign.
Yeah.
Not for advocating killing babies.
No, you have to get your moral priorities straight.
it's sick.
Really an unforgivable sin.
Yes,
wear blackface for some reason or other, as opposed to killing a defenseless infant on the operating table, which is a virtuous act.
It's a good thing because they'll discuss it with the doctor.
If that isn't the world turned upside down, I don't know what is. And we have to get to the heart of who gave that to us, who did that. Who are we to hold responsible for this mess?
Well, according to Bernard Nathanson.
Yeah, he's the one who said it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But again, today's rhetoric, given today's environment, you can't do that. Although it's getting, I think, easier because of research and work like yours, because you're giving us the grammar to address this in a way that is both informed, mature, and you're giving us the language we can use that was
been irrefutable.
It's irrefutable.
And you know what the proof that this is irrefutable? Do you know what the proof is? They censor you on YouTube.
Yes.
When you say it.
Yes. Yeah. My last interview of yours was censored within like 2 hours. So what can you do? Well, I mean, so this article was really interesting because this is a history of post-war Germany that I was somewhat familiar with. I didn't quite know the details of this, of the sort of the moral corruption of Germany in the post-war era. I was familiar with things like, you know, like the Morgenthau Plan and how it was partially implemented via Eisenhower's death camps, the Rhine-Meadow camps. Most people have a vision of post-war Germany as American troops coming in and hanging out chocolate bars and liberating them from the tyranny of, you know, tyrannies of the Nazis. But they're not familiar, you know, with the hunger winter and this plan to destroy Germany and these things, and how just the sort of the necessities of the Cold War saved Germany physically, but it also created a situation where they could be corrupted spiritually. Now we're seeing today where now Germany may be facing actual physical destruction as the people are so demoralized, they're not reproducing, and they're being inundated with these foreign workers or immigrants or migrants or refugees, whatever you want to call them. And the leadership, the childless leadership of Europe seems completely unconcerned with this. So
that's right. Yep. So. That's right. Not one head of state in Europe has a child.
Yeah. So, well, Dr. Jones, I want to thank you. You have anything else you want to say about this, or think we covered it?
I think we've covered it. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Well, that is, again, that's Dr. E. Michael Jones. The long article is now in book form on Amazon. You can get it either in paperback or ebook, and I recommend you get the book. It's Beyond the Bomb, Werner Heisenberg and Jewish Science. The second part is being published in this month's February edition of Culture Wars magazine, culturewars.com. I want to thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'll let you go, and when I post this, I'll be posting it shortly. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Good night, Ken. Bye-bye.
Okay, good night.
Good night.